hustling, but it's also much more. It's the heart of the art form that we all adore. Your friendly neighborhood comic book store. Out among the stacks of new releases, browsing with your future new best friends, you're gonna find the book you love to pieces. The girl behind the counter recommends dollar books and shelves of graphic novels. Action figures, board games, toys, and models to add to your new Comic Wednesday haul. The comic book store, the comic book store, 'cause that's where the books live, but it's also much more. It's the heart of the art form that we all adore. Your friendly neighborhood comic book store.
Good evening, everybody. This is Source Material Live. I'm your host for the time being, the Mandated Reporter and Frankly Unmortified, Mr. Mark Ratledge. And tonight, we are discussing the 14-part limited series, the sequel to Batman The Long Halloween, Batman Dark Victory, written by Jeff Loeb, art by Tim Sale. It was published between November 1999 and December of 2000. Joining me tonight to talk about this from Honeysuckle Rose Creations, it's Alexis Haina. How do you do, madam?
Hey, doing pretty good.
Great, outstanding. I know this is one that we talked about covering back when we did Catwoman When in Rome earlier in the year, so I'm happy to have gotten this on the schedule and have you back to discuss it.
Absolutely. I really did enjoy discussing When in Rome, plug. Not to mention, it's been ages since I read Long Halloween, but most people, I believe, would consider that a common staple of any true comic book collector.
Yeah, I think it's in most people's top 10 Batman graphic novels. Also joining the show tonight is former title card artist for The Long Road to Ruin, our good friend of the network, Benjamin J. Colon. How do you do, sir?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Former and maybe future Long Road to Ruin title card artist. We'll see what happens.
Well, it'll be great to have you back. I still have your artwork hanging on my wall. Every once in a while, my son walks up to me and goes, "Now, who are all these people supposed to be again in the Dark Knight one?" And I have to keep telling him, I'm like, "That's Robert, that's Sean, that's me and you as a baby, and your mom and your sister in the background." He's like, "Oh." And then he'll ask me again the next day. But that's okay.
Yeah. I would say I've still got the prints that you custom ordered from me for hair barrettes, Ben.
Yeah, I know. My niece loves them.
Wonderful.
All right, so, Alexis, when was the first time you've read Dark Victory? Was it for this show today, or had you read it before?
It was for this show. I'm just going to go ahead and play the ignorant card. I didn't know there was a sequel to Long Halloween until you brought it up. So I had honestly never read this book before. I had never really even heard of it before. But again, you brought it up and I was really happy to get my hands on this. I'm like, "Oh, cool. This is all connected. Neat." So, you know, I'm going to just play dumb here and admit that you two are probably going to know a little bit more than I will on this.
Ben, you requested to be on the show. Apparently you've got a passion for this book. When was the first time you read it?
A couple of years ago. I had heard about it like as it was coming out. I didn't get a chance to read it as it was coming out, but I'd heard about it. You know, there was an article in Wizard magazine about like halfway through while the book was coming out, and they sort of did their own speculation as to, you know, I don't think it's any big spoiler, like, before we talk about this, to say that this is a big old murder mystery, a lot like Long Halloween was. So they did, you know, their own speculation about halfway through the publication of the story about who the killer was, and that's how I first heard about it. And I ended up reading it in its entirety much later. I probably should have read Long Halloween first. A lot of the things in this would make a lot more sense if I had, but I ended up reading this first and then going back and reading Long Halloween and then reading this, you know, and then reading this, and then, you know, it made a lot more sense and it fit together a lot. I haven't reread up until today. I hadn't reread it in a while, so I'm with a somewhat more critical eye. I, you know, took a few more notes, and I actually started noticing a few parallels between this and Long Halloween also that I thought were kind of fun.
So the story takes place after the Long Halloween. Now, the Long Halloween, there was a killer who, on every holiday, once a month or so, was killing people throughout the, I think it was the Falcone family, and it turns out it ends up being Alberto Falcone, who was trying to one-up his father and prove he's more capable of handling the family business. So this finds Alberto in Arkham Asylum opposite the Calendar Man, who was none too thrilled that somebody was moving in on his territory, which is killing people, according to the calendar. And in the Long Halloween, the wife of Falcone ends up falling off a building, and she's in a wheelchair, and she's got a halo on. At this point, Harvey Dent has had acid thrown in his face. He's become Two-Face, and this is very early on in the identity of Two-Face. He's at Arkham Asylum as well. And we find our heroes and villains here. Janice Porter has replaced Harvey Dent as the district attorney, and she is, of course, none too fond of Batman and the way he does things, and she also wants to reopen the Alberto Falcone case. She ends up doing so, and this results in Alberto Falcone being released and living at his father's mansion, where he starts hearing voices, and he thinks he's hearing the voice of his father. Murders start up again, and this time it's various cops, first of which are ones that are retired, and then there's more active ones, and this is happening about once a month. Evidence points that it's Two-Face, and Two-Face goes out of his way to prove that it's not him. He's not the one causing this, though he does have an agenda of his own as well. As the story moves forward, it's revealed that it's Sophia Falcone who is known as the Hangman Killer, and she can actually walk. So she was faking it the whole time, and she was planting evidence pointing at Two-Face as the killer as a misdirect. This is also one takes the origin of Robin at one point. The mob pours acid on the ropes of the Flying Graysons, and of course his parents die in a terrible accident, and he ends up being adopted by Batman, and Robin, Dick Grayson, is the first person, I think, besides Alfred, to have Batman reveal his identity, and he becomes, by the end of the book, he becomes Robin. That's the brief synopsis of the book. So let's start with thematically, Alexis. The book deals with Batman's sort of survivor's guilt over what happened with Harvey Dent. There's a lot of discussion over having lost Harvey as a friend and an ally, and how Batman feels about that. He's tormented. He's tortured. He talks about being alone at the beginning of the book, as does Commissioner Gordon. There's a lot of subplot here having to do with him trying to get his wife back. And so the characters start off in the book in this really, really dark place. And they're, you know, Batman especially feels like he can't get this wrong anymore. He can't be wrong. He's still wanting to try to rehabilitate Harvey. What did you think of those themes in this book, you know, and how Batman is portrayed?
I always do appreciate when the writers dive into the story between Batman and Harvey Dent. As I've mentioned before on the show, my introduction to Batman was actually not the comics, it was the animated series. And one of the things that I loved so much about that was how they really established Dent's character before turning him into Two-Face. And I love that you see how close he is with Batman, and you get a lot of that here. And I really like the way they're building this up, how Dent and Bruce knew each other, how close they were, and it really does impact you, and you feel the same guilt that he is going through. You know, the idea that he couldn't do anything to save him during that whole ordeal with Holiday. I'm also just going to go ahead and ask this. Who the hell at Arkham thought it was a good idea to put Holiday and Calendar Man facing one another? I mean, I just looked at it and I was like, okay, so apparently somebody at Arkham likes to organize the bad guys according to theme. Who knew?
Well, how else are you going to organize them, really?
I'm sorry, that was just the first thing I thought. I was like, okay, so over here is the calendar theme bad guys. Over there is
here's our clowns
theme bad guys.
Clowns over here, mafia ones over here, calendar ones over me.
Exactly.
The doctors have a really good sense of humor.
Yeah, it kind of helps the feng shui of the whole place.
Yeah, it cuts down on breakouts. So instead of, you know, every other day, it's, you know, it's every third day.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if there's anything that could cut down on the number of breakouts at Arkham. It seems like they're almost hourly at one point.
Yeah, Arkham is the least secure mental health facility I've ever seen. But you were saying about Batman and the guilt and everything.
Like I said, it's a story arc that I really do appreciate. So much of Batman is him simply trying to analyze what's going on around him, analyze the people he's going after, try to get inside the minds of the bad guys. With Dent, he's always second-guessing himself because he can't quite separate who Dent was and who he is now. And that leads to a really great inner battle with Bruce.
What about you, Ben? How do you appreciate the Jeff Loeb's attempt to really draw out of Batman this sort of guilt-ridden figure, this tortured figure? I mean, he's you know, tortured by just trying to honor his family, as if that wasn't enough, you know, and the trauma of having seen his parents get shot. Now, on top of that trauma, he's got another layer of trauma having to deal with Harvey Dent.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if every version of the trade for this story has the same introduction by Tim Sale, but they talk a little bit about what Jeff Loeb wanted to do with the story and how he wanted to tell Robin's origin story ultimately. So it felt to me like, you know, they were making it, and it's not at all subtle, like what Batman's supposed to be feeling throughout this story is, because he says it repeatedly in his own like internal monologue. You know, he keeps saying, "I am alone. I'm by myself. I have to do this myself." There's one point where he's talking about the police and their camaraderie, and he's like, "Yeah, but I'm not one of them." So what that does is that's directly intent. You know, it's pretty obvious. That's directly intended to set up later on sort of overcoming that and realizing that he can't be alone, that it's sort of necessary for him to sort of overcome the guilt that he felt and the isolation that he sort of imposed on himself after the events of Long Halloween in order to be more effective at what he's doing, and in order to, you know, sort of evolve as a person, both as Bruce and as Batman. And that's, you know, how we get Robin and how he fits into, you know, Batman's world. So it's set up early on, and we don't even get mention of the Flying Graysons until I think like 2/3 of the way through the story, but that was where it was going the whole time.
You know, one of the things that comes out in this, and you know, years later when they do the wedding book, it irritated me because Here, this is supposed to be early on in Batman's career, like 3 or 4 years into him being the Batman, and he has a self-imposed, you know, like you were talking about, isolation. You know, he doesn't want help from people, but not only that, and where I'm going with this is, he doesn't seem to feel like he deserves any kind of happiness. Like, he deserves any kind of companionship. Like, what I get from the story, and I get from his, especially in the first couple of issues, the inner monologue is, and this relates to his dealing with Selina Kyle, Catwoman, is how much he doesn't feel like he deserves to be with somebody and be happy. And just as an aside, that's what annoyed me about the wedding. One was he finally like got over that, and he was, you know, willing to accept love in his life, and he was going to marry Catwoman, and the authors were like, no, Batman can never be happy. And I was like, why are you taking that away from us? Dad, god damn it.
Because it's comic books.
He finally completed the arc, and it was like, nope, out comes the rug right from under you. But I'll throw it back to you guys. You know these thoughts about Batman's belief that he doesn't deserve to be happy, and to that extent, how no matter how much Selina Kyle tries to open up to him, try to be a part of his life, be his partner, he just treats her so bad, you know, and not necessarily meaning to, like, he can't help himself, you know, and he can't seem to accept her companionship even when she's throwing herself at him. So, you know, what did you think of all of that and, you know, the relationship between Batman and Catwoman, Alexis?
Sorry, I'm just trying to think of the way to say this. It is interesting to look at it like this because I'm more used to the previous story arcs where Catwoman was a bit more complicated when she threw as a companion for Batman because she was a little bit more active as a criminal. So it was more of a love-hate thing. This is a bit much more different way to see it, where it's clear that in this book, she is not acting as a criminal. She legit wants to help him. She wants to be with him.
Just as an aside, she also makes a point of saying, I only stole from the Falcone family. And I guess she sort of implying that this was her way of dealing with the belief that she was somehow a part of the Falcone family, that Falcone may or may not have been her father. You know, she makes a point of saying she wasn't robbing anyone else at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old true lies excuse. Like, did you kill anybody? Yeah, but they were all bad.
Right.
Ocean's 11 line, it's like, you're a liar and a thief. I only lied about being a thief.
Yes, I only steal from the truly awful, and that's what makes it okay. Anyway, you were talking about their relationship.
Like I said, it's just a little interesting to look at this one where she is walking more the line of being, I'm trying to think, more chaotic good, I would say,
mm-hmm.
than chaotic neutral. And I'm just going to say it. I said this during our Win in Rome review. I am not a huge fan of this design of Catwoman's costume.
Yes, with the whiskers and the tail that she can somehow control.
Yes, exactly. We get that one scene of her curling up next to Batman on the roof, and she somehow has managed to get her tail wrapped around him. And I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of cute. How the hell is she moving that thing?
Yeah, the Catwoman in an actual cat outfit made no sense to me. You know, the way she's drawn now, where she's more of wearing just a pleather outfit with goggles, makes more sense because she's Catwoman because she's a cat burglar, not because she's half cat. And it would make more sense for a cat burglar to be wearing something like Anne Hathaway wore in the Dark Knight Rises, or the way she's drawn now in modern comics, as I said, where she looks more like a thief and less ridiculous.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I've said this before, but when I see the whiskers on her, I know cats have whiskers. I know most animals have whiskers. My corgi, who's currently asleep behind me, has whiskers. But when I look at the whiskers and the ears, I don't see a cat, I see a mouse.
You know, yeah. Looking back, yeah.
So
hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, we talked about that. We talked about that quite a bit during the When in Rome thing. By the way, When in Rome makes so much more sense now why she fucked off and went to Italy. The way that she gets treated in this book. Ben, what did you think of Batman and his self-imposed loneliness and the way he treats Catwoman?
Yeah, just as an aside, I feel the same way about where the whole Batman Catwoman thing ultimately went in the comics recently, as you do, Mark. But then again, I was subjected to Spider-Man One More Day, so like it. This is something that's like kind of across the board where, like, you know, apparently superheroes must wallow in eternal misery for some reason.
It does get a little old after a while. Obviously, Batman's going to play the dark vigilante. That's part of the character arc that we love about him. But yeah, I think after a while, even I'm saying, my God, man, Papa Prozac, and shut up.
It gets extremely old and extremely annoying, and just they wrestled with that through that entire run that Tom King had done on Batman. I don't want this to become a whole discussion about that, but they dealt with that a lot, and they still copped out at the end, which I'm just like, why'd you even bother then?
I had this problem with, and I can't remember the writer's name, but there was a Spider-Man where he was the head of a tech company and he was doing really well, and then they took it all away from him and he was sleeping on Mockingbird's couch and he was starting all over again from scratch. And that's where this writer picks up, where he's, you know, down on he's exactly where he was in the 60s. He's down on his luck, you know, he's a schmuck, and he's, you know, just trying to figure things out. And he's like, "You're like 50 years old, Spider-Man. Why?"
That's my old buddy Dan Slott, who's writing. I have a very love-hate relationship with.
Yes, yes, the Dan Slott Spider-Man. I screamed about how terrible that was.
He's responsible for virtually the entire 10-year period after One More Day. So, take that for what you will. Anyway, back to what you were asking me. I got this sense, like I said, that Batman seems to think, at least in this story and at this point in his existence, and like I said, like Long Halloween and Dark Victory are supposed to take place not too long after Batman Year One by Frank Miller. So a lot of the themes of that, you know, get very, you know, seriously expanded upon, you know, feelings of loss, feelings of isolation, feelings of, you know, where do I fit in and how do I reconcile, you know, this vow that I've taken to avenge my parents' death with being an actual functioning human being. And he almost gets into this mindset in this story where he feels like Batman can't function the way he thinks Batman needs to function unless he's alone and unless he's got a certain degree of misery and he's carrying a certain weight on him. I think he makes explicit reference to that at some point. It's something like, you know, only, you know, the responsibility is mine alone. I forget exactly where that falls in the story, but I remember reading it. As far as with Catwoman, you know, that's always been like the dynamic that they had. Like I said, they, you know, the more recent arc took it to more interesting places where, you know, it's not just a will they won't they kind of thing. It's not just a, you know, cat and mouse, you know, insert your pun here, sort of thing. It's here in this story, it's very much like, you know, not just that I can't have you in my life, but more like your presence in my life is a distraction.
Yeah, I don't like this relationship. Quite frankly, I always prefer them when she's out there in the world, she's stealing from people, she, you know, she's this corrupted, but fun and, you know, carefree individual that he's trying to tame. You know, he's trying to make a, you know, make an honest woman out of her, and she's like, nope. You know, banging on top of a rooftop, sure. You know, but I'm not a kept woman, and I never will be. And I much prefer that dynamic than this where, you know, where he's like, get away from me, kid, you bother me.
Yeah, I give it a somewhat more of a pass in this story just because of the theme that they're trying to get across. They're trying to really, like, you know, they're trying to, you know, strangle you with, may they may or may not be trying to use a noose to do it, but with the idea that Batman is a loner. Batman is such a loner. He's such a loner. He's such a complete loner. He's such a, oh look, he's got a sidekick now. So they kind of beat you over the head with that so much, and I kind of give it a pass in that. Jeff Loeb actually explored this idea a lot better in Hush, I think. Like this same idea of where where Selina Kyle fits into his life, and you know she could easily fit better into his life if he'd stop being such a stubborn pain in the ass about it. So I give it more of a pass because this is young Batman, relatively speaking. But
yeah, get me wrong. I don't think it's bad writing. As a reader, it produces feelings in me where I feel bad for Catwoman.
Yeah. Right. I like it more of the unspoken truth between them. The idea that they do care for each other, but they're caught in this game of her constantly stealing and Batman knowing that even though he wants to be with her, he has to, you know, stay morally right and he has to, you know, try to stop her. And I just love the way they kind of tease each other back and forth through that. I mean, again, going back to the animated series, you got that great classic line where Catwoman goes, you have to admit there's something between us, and Batman goes, yeah, it's the law.
That line
perfectly sums up their relationship for me.
And then she throws him off a roof.
Well, like, of course.
Like
you do. Thank you. Right on cue.
The Batman The Long Halloween, what makes it a superior story and I think continues with Dark Victory, is this isn't the punchy ninja Batman who feels like an unstoppable wrecking machine. This is the detective Batman. And I feel like that's the best Batman. Batman, I think, is best written when there's a mystery to solve and not necessarily when he's just punching through things. It's one of the things I liked about the Nolan Batman, you know, and I'm hoping that we get with, allegedly that's what we're getting with this Robert Pattinson Batman next year. It's more detective noir and not necessarily, you know, playing too much on the superhero aspect of Batman. So one of the things I liked about Dark, you know, this follows the same kind of beats as The Long Halloween. Almost every issue, someone gets hung, and you know, and Batman is just bereft of clues. He can't figure out, you know, he can't figure out what the connections are. He's misreading clues. That's actually later on, Robin sort of points something out to him that he hadn't thought of. You know, there's a scene where he's interrogating the Riddler. This is the Batman that I like, and this is why I think these two stories complement each other nicely, The Long Halloween and Dark Victory. Go ahead and let's talk about that for a little minute. You know, when Batman is the detective, Alexis.
Sorry, I don't really know where to go from that. I mean,
do you want me to go over to Ben?
Yeah, go to Ben first. I'm kind of struggling to think how I want to word it.
Okay, Ben. What do you think of these stories that focus on these two stories that focus on Batman as the detective?
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm with you 100%. Detective Batman's my favorite Batman, and the best Batman stories are the ones that balance that out quite well. Maybe, you know, two thirds detective to like one third ass kicking is like my ideal like Batman formula. you know,
I actually like to see Batman get his ass kicked once in a while, and you know, he gets hung in this one. He gets it. He gets beat up a few times.
Cool reveal with the neck brace, by the way.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
I can't remember if I anticipated that like when I first read this. Probably not, but it's. I wasn't surprised when they revealed it as much as, you know, I was like, you know, that seems like something you do, but it's clever, but yeah, that's Batman, all right. always plans ahead. If you know, he's also not exactly the seasoned detective. This Jeff Loeb plays a lot upon, you know, a lot of the early Batman stuff. Some of the reason, like he's admitted in the past that the reason why he does so many stories that take place in certain characters' past is because he doesn't want to get bogged down by like current continuity and current baggage. So he has a lot of fun playing around with, you know, younger versions of these characters, and with Batman, he's not quite a seasoned detective. He's a little bit more hot-headed. He's a little bit more. He's analytical as hell. He's quick to jump to the wrong conclusion instead of really analyzing everything from every angle and reanalyzing it and analyzing it again. But it creates an interesting outcome because he
makes
not,
Batman,
you know,
seem more vulnerable.
Exactly. He can be wrong, which is a thing that he has a big problem with in this story. So it's another conflict that's introduced entirely by himself against himself that works really, really well.
Yeah, it's one of the things I really, really liked about this is that he's not perfect. I think too many of the modern Batman stories, you know, he can take on an army full of people by himself. You know, he's got, you know, he figures stuff out in like instantaneously. He just walks in the room and he's like, oh, I already know who did it. You know, I like the fact that Batman struggles in this. You know, this is really good storytelling that he doesn't, that, you know, that he's going down the wrong path, that, you know, that out of anger and frustration, you know, he like resorts to just beating on people. You know, there were a lot of elements of this in the Nolan Batman, especially The Dark Knight. You know, I'm reminded of the scene where he's questioning the Joker, and the first thing he does is, you know, bang his head into the table, and the Joker says, "Never start with the head." It makes them woozy; they can't answer questions.
Hey, I've seen that movie a million times. I'm still trying to figure out the scene with the fingerprints on the bullet.
I vaguely remember that.
It's magic.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I'll go ahead and give you this. I agree that it's great to see Batman as a detective. The problem is I feel that a lot of writers and by extension a lot of filmmakers don't know how to properly do it without making it come across as boring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sorry, Batman will always be an awesome character, but just having him sit and ponder sitting at the bat computer all day is never going to make for that interesting of a story. So I think that's one of the reasons we don't get to see him be a true detective that much, is I don't think a lot of writers know how to make that as interesting as, you know, Batman Punch.
I think that's why they did that scene in The Dark Knight where he's like, you know, CSI-ing the bullet, because it's actually interesting visually.
Well, I'll go in the opposite direction of what you're saying, Alexis. Not that I disagree with you, but I think for a lot of readers, it's not that the writers can't make it interesting, is the readers have no patience for it. Like, readers like the three of us who obviously like this sort of thing and are willing to be patient with it, but, you know, as I often like to quote these days, there's the audience out there that just wants the punchy parts.
Yeah, there's the audience out there that played the Batman Arkham games, and the only thing they remember about that is Batman punched a shark.
Hey, I was great at the combat part of that game.
Hey, I'm sorry. I will always remember that with a friend of mine playing, and I'm like, Batman, did he just fucking punch a shark?
I tried with that game. I didn't get very far. All right, let's turn this around. Let's look at some of our villains here. So, Harvey Dent... who's Two-Face, he escapes during the initial Arkham breakout along with everybody else, like you do. And he's got his own thing going on. He's got a team-up of the Joker, Poison Ivy, Mad Hatter, and Mr. Freeze, and he's got them out running missions for him. They're taking
and
out
Scarecrow.
There's actually a great part of this book I love where Batman's like questioning Scarecrow. He's like, "Tell me what I want to know, or I'll throw you back in the fire." Like, yeah.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. It's like, so how much straw did you actually put into that costume to make it look authentic?
How about a little fire, Scarecrow? Was it a
bottom bump?
But he's got his own agenda, which was a little confusing for me, and I'll tell you why. You know, in the Long Halloween, that you know, once Carmine Falcone is dead, there's that splash page, if I remember correctly, and it's all of the freak show villains, and it's like Gotham belongs to us now. And where we find ourselves here is there's still plenty of mob families out there. The Falcone family is still going, even without Carmine. Two-Face's agenda is seemingly to continue what started in the Long Halloween of getting rid of the mobs altogether and have it solely belong to the Arkham crowd, which I feel like was narratively a bit of a step back. Narratively and thematically, I think it was a bit of a step back to the Long Halloween. I feel like these are the same notes being played all over again. But to Jeff Loeb's credit, he has fun with this. He has them doing fun and interesting things. The Joker is always hilarious. I don't know how he didn't end up killing Sophia Falcone when he threw her down the stairs a second time. But whatever. Talk to me. I'll go to Ben first this time. Talk to me about your thoughts on Two-Face and the freaks trying to take out the mob and the mob trying to continue to exist in this world where freaks are taking them out.
Yeah, I like the dynamic there because it makes it adds another kind of dimension to the story where it's not just like a murder mystery, but it's also a story about a gang war and about like, you know, the old guard versus the young punks and these new freaks. You know, they're all psychopaths and they can't be understood and they're all weirdos and they have no loyalty or no honor and no allegiance to anything in particular. So
it's got to be hard to get shit done when you're in the mob, right? And you've got, you know, the Joker just running around setting shit on fire, hitting people with gas, making them die laughing. You're like, we're just trying to sell drugs here. What, like, why are we got to complicate this?
Well, that's why there's an interesting, like, sort of thread throughout this story that, while the mob is trying to get back to business and you know, the Arkham freaks keep disrupting things, including the sort of specter of, you know, Two-Face is out there and nobody knows where he is and nobody knows what his plan is. So the unpredictability of like all of the people that, you know, all of the inmates that got broken out of the asylum has got everybody on edge, and like they're the, you know, the mob knows how to deal with each other, but they don't know how to deal with this element. So they're like all of these new characters and all of these criminally insane people, it's an element that scares even the mob, and you know, it's certainly kind of, it even has the cops on edge. And, Commissioner Gordon eventually, you know, puts together his own task force and they start getting picked off too. But the idea is to, you know, try to sort of take on both of these sides of this gang war. You know, one has got the muscle and the other one has got like the element of surprise. The cops are caught in the middle. Batman's caught in the middle. And it leads to some really cool, you know, dynamics that play out throughout basically the second half of the story than the first. They do good job of setting it up in the first so that, you know, basically all hell breaks loose in the second half.
I don't know how Two-Face was represented throughout the history in the comics, but I know in the show he was a tough villain in the cartoon. Alexis, Two-Face was always like extra difficult, whereas the Joker was unpredictable, but in an anarchist way. You know, like, you never, his thing was these elaborate setups to mess with Batman and the city just to do it. You had Two-Face, who was written being really, really intelligent, always being one step ahead of Batman, but also having that mob mentality, which I think Jeff Loeb captures in Dark Victory. You know, there's that scene specifically where they set up Jim just so he can save him, and to prove, like, hey, I'm not the hangman killer. And by the way, if you come after me, I'll shoot you dead. I've got snipers on rooftops. You know,
exactly.
So I was curious, since you're such a fan of the cartoon, if this Two-Face is the Two-Face you recognize.
It definitely is. The escalation of the villains is something that I really appreciate when we see it more in the comics. We saw it really well done in the Nolan films, and it's part of the reason why I could never take the Gotham TV series all that seriously.
Ugh, that's such tripe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I tried watching it, and I just realized that it suddenly turned into a continuous run of the meme where Captain America looks up and goes, "I understood that reference." I like the idea that when Batman first shows up, it is not the Gotham that we know from the cartoons and the movies and the comics. It is gang run. It is mob run. It's when Batman shows up that the villains, they escalate, They basically realize it's like, okay, this is a different sort of fight than the cops. This means that Gotham is ready for a new kind of villain. And I love seeing that grow, and how these characters were not always there. They were not always part of Gotham. So I like the idea that this is showing this book is kind of describing the evolution. We're seeing these new villains who we know are going to take out huge chunks of Gotham, and we're seeing the mob who know that they're on the way to extinction, and they're not ready to go down without a fight.
Yeah, I really like the way they do Two-Face in this book. I like the fact that, he very often has Batman's number, and Batman really has to, try and figure out what Two-Face's ultimate game is. It added to the basic mystery of who is the hangman killer. Anything more about Two-Face before we move on?
Again, he's always been one of my favorite of the Batman villains. I mean, I'm not going to lie, he's not my absolute favorite. My absolute favorite has always been Scarecrow. But I really do like how well they capture the torture that he's going inside through what has happened to him. I love how so often people keep calling him Harvey and Dent and trying to bring him back by calling him Harvey and Dent. You get this great scene with the DEA, where she's trying to get him on her side. And she keeps calling him, Harvey, and it's like, really bad time to remember that that's not what he goes by anymore, sweetie.
Yeah, let's talk about Janice Porter for a minute. Ben, were you surprised by the reveal that she was working for Harvey, that she was a double agent, or did you see that coming?
I was pretty surprised, and I don't think I should have been, because if you go and look back at some of the earlier scenes, like, it's not as... It's more obvious than they probably intended it to be. But, ultimately the reveal was pretty good. The fact that, I don't know how... I don't know if I caught on to whether or not Harvey was using her, or if he really, kind of had feelings for her, or both, because, He's got two completely distinct personalities.
Yeah, I would say with his antisocial personality, that she was a means to an end. She was there for what he needed when he needed it, and when he had no more use for her, as clearly shown in the book, he just, the Joker tries to use her as leverage, and he just shoots her in the head.
Right. And which is actually a pretty good, that's a good scene just for mm-hmm. Joker's reaction.
Yeah.
Yuck.
By the way, can I just say, am I the only one who really did not like the design of the Joker in this book?
Never, ever, ever liked the way Tim Sale draws the Joker.
Yeah, you guys got ahead of me on this one. I was going to ask about the artwork, because the one who I hated was Poison Ivy. I think the poison ivy with the pixelated bush head looks ridiculous.
Poison Ivy was drawn actually a lot better in Long Halloween. I don't know why Tim Sale decided to go this way in this book, but she looked a lot better in Long Halloween.
Agreed. Mr. Freeze, I thought, looked pretty decent. And Scarecrow didn't look too bad, but he was a little too angular for my taste. I think they got a little too carried away with the texture on his costume. But Joker just kills me every time. I look at that, and all I can think is that 90s comic, the Max, with the giant... The big purple guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sorry, I just look at the giant teeth and the elongated chin, I'm like, okay, I didn't need a flashback to the 90s this badly, thank you.
Well, what kills me is that, like, he draws, Tim Sale in the book, draws Batman and draws Alfred and Commissioner Gordon and Porter reasonably well, you know, in terms of these people look like humans. And then we get to the bad guys and everyone looks like a monster.
I think in some cases that works, and that's probably like stylistically intentional. It's probably you know, they're probably supposed to look less human than, you know, everybody else because that's the way you're supposed to look at them. It does get taken to an extreme. The one that he probably without fail gets every time though is Two-Face, and it's a lucky thing seeing as how much Two-Face is in this story.
Mm-hmm. He draws
an awesome Two-Face. I want that suit, by the way.
Yeah, no kidding. With the way he exaggerates all of the other characters' designs, their costumes and everything, Two-Face could have looked goddamn ridiculous.
You know, what kills me is how some writers really do capture the essence, and in this case Jeff Loeb, really capture the essence of Two-Face so well. It hurts me to watch the Batman Forever and see how badly he's messed up and how poorly he's portrayed by Tommy Lee Jones. And that's not Tommy Lee Jones' fault. That's the, you know, he's this is the direction he was given.
He wanted to downplay it.
I was saying those were the notes the studio gave to the director.
Yeah. My last question to you guys, and then I'll kind of open it up in case there's stuff that you guys wanted to talk about that we missed. The reveal that the Hangman is actually a walking, talking, fully functional, bald-headed Sophia Falcone. What did you think of that? You know, when we finally get that reveal that that's who it is, had you figured it out by then, or were you shocked that it was Sophia, and how'd you feel about it? Ben.
Which one of you ask? Oh, Ben.
No, I didn't guess it, and I actually do like the reveal. Once again, this is a thing where, like, you picked up on it much more if you read Long Halloween first, because in Dark Victory, she's confined to the wheelchair for most of the story. You don't get a sense of what you got a sense of in Long Halloween, which is that Sophia is a huge, huge woman. I think when we talked about Long Halloween, when I was on Jesse's podcast, you know, when we additionally talked about Long Halloween, I think we settled on if Chris Cyborg was in the mob or something like that.
Sure.
Something like, you know, if you want a frame of if you want some kind of frame of reference for that, it's like that. So they go to great lengths also to tell you that to explain to you that a lot of these hangman killing these hangman killings required somebody who was capable of like some serious strength, because the first thing with the very first murder, they explain how it's done. They explain like through the forensic evidence that somebody literally had to throw the noose on the victim's neck and hoist them up. It's not, you know, they weren't dropped, they were lifted.
It's the Phantom of the Opera style.
Yeah, so that comes into play, you know, that's first intended to misdirect you completely away from, you know, from anybody who would not have the strength to do that. So that rules out, you know, Alberto, who has, you know, the mangled right hand. It's supposed to rule out Sophia, who was thought to be, paraplegic and confined to the wheelchair, and despite her size, she couldn't move. They try to misdirect you a couple of times with that, like including the time that the Joker chucks her down the stairs.
That was so brilliant the way that he basically says, okay, I'm going to shoot you if you don't move, because you never see the look on her face. You never get a close-up of how she's reacting to all this. And I think that could have been a big spoiler. The idea is like looking at her and think and trying to give across the idea, do I risk this? Do I move now? Or is he actually going to shoot me? That was really well done.
And you know, the game could have been up then and there, you know, if she was forced to do something, which I think she would have. It turns out, you know, Alberto saves her life, but that, you know, it's a good enough misdirect to make it really surprising when it's revealed that, you know, that it's her, that it was her the whole time. And then it makes sense that, you know, she had the capability to do that the whole time. And it's a strange reveal, and that's, by the way, that's something Jeff Loeb is known for. He does a lot of, whenever he gets his hands on Batman, he will craft a 12 to 14 issue mystery of some kind, and he loves having a wacky out of nowhere, like out of left field reveal. In all of, the reveal at the end of Hush was weird. I mean it worked strictly in terms of the direction the story took, but it was still a weird reveal.
Yeah, look at Hush, When in Rome, Long Halloween, they all had crazy Shyamalan-esque twists.
Yeah, and you know, as somebody that's read like other stuff that he's done, it works a lot better when he's writing Batman than anything else. Like, outside of Batman, when he tries to do that, I call him Captain Anticlimax, because it's not. He wrote a Spider-Man story. He wrote Spider-Man Blue that tried to do something similar, where there's a reveal that's supposed to come up at the very end, and I don't know if you guys have ever read that or heard of it. The reveal at the end, it sucks.
Okay.
I have to say, I enjoyed the reveal. Whenever I have to read one of these books for the show, I can always tell about midway through how I'm doing with it. Like, if I'm really, really enjoying it, I'm not exhausted halfway through and can't, like, starting to, like, scan read. You know, like, you know, blah, blah, I don't need to read this. Okay, I got you. Like, I'm not racing to finish this. This had me enraptured from beginning to end. And when it was finally revealed that it was her, I had kind of an oh shit moment. I was like, oh wow, yeah, I would not have thought it was the cripple who apparently isn't crippled. All right, good, you know, that boy, is that a long play? You know, like she had to have figured out, you know, shortly after the fall, that she was going to do this in order for that to have worked. You know what I mean? Like, you know, she had, at some point, she would have had to have really been in a wheelchair and goes, I'm going to keep this up and I'm going to get revenge on all these people. I would assume.
Yeah. The best I can say about that whole mystery and the reveal is it's earned on.
Yeah.
And that's not always the case. A lot of, you know, a lot of people who sort of profess to be mystery writers, and a lot of people who try to set up a mystery will base the reveal on something that, you know, that does not go logically from one thing to another. It's usually people who write the ending first and work backwards, without really knowing how they're going to connect the dots together. Like, I don't know how many mystery, like, if you guys read a lot of mystery books or a lot of mystery comics, the good ones are really, really good, and the bad ones are god awful.
I just read The Fade Out, which was a detective noir story set in Hollywood, which I really enjoyed. I like a good detective story, and, you know, it helps when they're well told. Alexis, any final thoughts here on the book? Anything that we haven't talked about? If you want to give your thoughts on the reveal of Sophia.
One of the things I really enjoyed, after I finished the book the other day and I went through today and kind of just skimmed through it. I like to do that to just be like, okay, what's, you know, I don't totally reread it, but I'll click through the pages quickly. Just like, okay, was there anything I missed? Was there anything particularly I want to talk about? One of the things I really liked about Sophia's reveal is if you go back and look through the book, yes, she is a very large woman, but the artwork goes out of its way to hide her real size. You can tell she's a little bit larger, but you don't get a true grasp of her real size. Most of the time she's in the shadow, she's constantly got a blanket over her, she's wearing, I don't know what that is, if it's like just a house coat or a very frumpy dress or whatever, but it's hiding most of her body. She's obviously, they designed to make it look like she's slouching a bit in the chair. You don't get an idea of just how big and imposing this woman actually is until you get that final scene of her, you know, amongst all the flames, having ripped the metal halo off, and you just want to realize, holy shit, Brianna Tarth has been juicing.
Right.
Yeah, she kind of has, the way she's drawn, she has that, like, China size. You know, just very broad-shouldered, she, you know, very mannish and like, woman.
And like I said, you'd have absolutely no clue about that, because, like Alexa said, Tim Sale goes to great lengths in the artwork in this story to hide that. So the only way you'd have any idea of that at all is if you, first of all, you had read Long Halloween, and even that, the way that this story is told is meant specifically to neutralize any suspicion that you might have based on that.
Alexis, go ahead and finish up. Give your final thoughts.
I really did enjoy this book. It's a really great follow-up to Long Halloween. And again, I mentioned that Long Halloween is a book that I think any serious comic collector should have on their shelf. You know what? I say add Dark Victory. I think it continues the story very well. I love the inclusion of the other characters. Yeah, some of the artwork is a little too crazy for my taste, especially some of the character designs. I will say this. The idea of giving Calendar Man the tattoos on his head was freaking brilliant.
Great.
I love the total Stigmata callback. Actually, my favorite part is, and I hate that we didn't even really get to talk about it, was the whole thing with Dick Grayson's adoption. You get this great bit where Robin, or when Dick sneaks into Thomas and Martha's old bedroom. He's a kid. He's got serious Scooby-Doo syndrome. He's going to go investigate. And I turn the page, and it's a black and white recreation. And at first, I thought this was an error in the printing. I was like, what the hell? But then the more you read on, you realize it's almost an exact parallel to right after Bruce lost his parents and he went into the room and was looking at the brush the same way Dick is. And this whole thing just must be a total crazy flashback for Alfred. And I was like, oh my God, that is so brilliant. The way I had no idea what was happening at first. That was so well done.
Yeah, I don't want to neglect talking about Robin. I have to say, and I wanted to make sure I said this on the show, you know, starting with I Am Alone for Batman, and then after he pairs up with Dick, and, you know, they take out all the bad guys and win the day, and he says, I am no longer alone, I was like, bravo! You know, that really got to me. I was super happy for this character, and I thought it was a brilliant way to end the book. Go ahead, Ben, your final thoughts on, if you want to talk a little bit more about Robin, and just give your final thoughts on the book.
Yeah, I'll specifically say there's two major things I don't want to leave without talking about. One of them was specifically related to, you know, introducing Robin in this story. That what I noticed, and it's really good, and it's actually one of the more subtle things in the story overall that Jeff Loeb set up, which is that, like you were saying before, Two-Face is at least one or two steps ahead of Bruce Batman at all times, and really a few steps ahead of just about everybody. And, you know, Batman and even, you know, the mob tries everything they can to stop him, and he's got a contingency and he's got a backup plan for everything, or he'll do like he did, you know, like he did with Janice Porter, and he'll scorch the earth and has no qualms about shooting her in the head if necessary, which is the same thing he ultimately does with Sophia, is, you know, right when she thinks she's got the upper hand, he puts a couple of bullets in her and the tables completely turn, you know, throughout that whole, you know, towards the end. And it turns out the only way that, this is, you know, you could this is how I, what I got out of it. The only way that Two-Face is beaten is when, is kind of when his own tactics are kind of used against him, or exploit, like his own narrow-mindedness is exploited, because he thinks he's got Batman's number because he knows what Batman is about. Batman is, you know, is a loner and he's by himself, and he and Two-Face come to learn how to exploit that in Batman. And then along comes Robin, and you know, he's not ready for that. He's not ready for a Batman that's working with a partner, that's working as a team with somebody else. He's used to loner Batman who shrugs off any help that he's offered, and he knows how to fight, how to combat that. He doesn't know how to combat Batman who's side by side with this wacky kid, and you know, and it gives him just enough pause for, you know, Batman and Robin to get, you know, to get the upper hand on him at the in the final battle. Which I thought was pretty cool, like how that came full circle. Like, you know, Two-Face thought he knew what Batman was about, and you know, when it turns out that Batman's capable of changing that, he's got no answer for it.
Awesome reveal, by the way, when you think the bad guys have broken into the Batcave, and you just see Robin grabbing, you don't even really see him, but you see like a hand grabbing the costume, and you just kind of get this big smile on your face, like, oh, shit's about to go down.
Yeah.
I cracked up when Batman looks at Robin and he's wearing his Flying Grayson's outfit. He's like, what are you wearing? It's like, just that acknowledgement that Robin's costume is ridiculous.
It's a better version of the, you know, who's your tailor scene in Batman Forever.
Yeah,
but, yeah. And 100%. Always goes back to that line from Tiny Toons: someone I can train, someone I can mentor, someone who can wear a brightly colored costume and draw all the fire. I mean, attention.
Yeah. One last thing I wanted to throw in here, because it was something I talked about with Long Halloween, and that is the Godfather references. I had to bring this in here. There is a lot fewer of them in this movie and in this story. They're a lot less subtle. Not that the ones in Long Halloween were all that subtle, but they're still there. My favorite one, there's a couple of them. Like, there's one where they're at Falcone's grave, and Sophia shows up with the detectives, and it's almost word for word the scene where Tom Hagen shows up in The Godfather with the detectives. So there's that. But
that's your word for it. I have not watched those movies in so long.
Me neither, but I've seen them enough to where, like, you know, there's some things that stick with you, especially, you know, because Loeb and Tim Sale kind of go to great lengths to make sure that you get the reference.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got any memory of it at all. My favorite one is when Janice's body gets dumped in Alberto Falcone's bed, like the horse head.
Oh.
Like the horse head in The Godfather. That surprised me. I didn't expect that they would go there with that reference in that way. Especially not that far into the story, where I thought they had kind of chilled out on the references by that point. But they definitely went there.
I didn't put two and two together, because every time I see a reference to the horse head, I see it as a joke. I mean, that scene's been played up for comedy so many times.
I don't know how much for comedy they were intending to play it up here, really. Like, I really don't know. I mean, it's meant to be terrifying in this case, in this story, but it's also kind of funny if you know the reference, I guess.
All right, Ben. Is there a particular reference you want to talk about from The Godfather that's in this one that you were like, well, for Pete's sake, why are you including this?
Let me see if did I write any of them down? Just those two in particular, like the, okay. Yeah, there's at least one or two more. The detective one, I was just kind of like, you guys are not trying as hard as you were before with these.
Okay.
That's where I got the sense of that.
Overall, I think we can all agree this is one of the better Batman stories. I think this is a great sequel to The Long Halloween, and it's and as I said on Facebook today and on Twitter, this is probably my favorite book we've read this year. When I think back to a lot of what I've read, you know, I've had some criticisms of this, or there was stuff where I was like, oh my God, I just want to finish this book already. This one, from start to finish, I was really into it. You know, loved every minute of this story, and just thought, you know, like, wow, I'm like, I kind of threw it on. Like, Alexis and I talked about this when we did Catwoman When in Rome, and just kind of threw it on the schedule as a lark. It's not connected to anything, and I'm glad I did. You know, so much of what we do here is connected to other things we're doing, you know, movies and TV shows. It's fun just to read a book because it's good. So that's Batman Dark Victory. I want to thank Alexis Haina and Benjamin J. Colon for coming on. You guys, you know, Alexis does almost every other book with me opposite Chris Sheehan, so she'll continue to do that. Benjamin, anytime you want to come back, if something tickles your fancy, let me know. Alexis, sure. Go ahead and plug your company.
All right, Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic. We're doing a little prep work right now. We just wrapped up our big Labor Day sale, and we're going to be kind of going and trying to work on a few things before we get ready to prep for the holiday season. Because let's face it, as soon as Halloween is over, it's going to be insanely crazy, and I'm not going to have any time to stop. So we are going to be working on some new products. We're currently discussing the idea of having our items being sold at a few shops. I actually just returned from a very long trip in Knoxville, Tennessee, and we did a little business with some of the shops down there. So those of you in the great state of Tennessee, keep a lookout on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You might be getting news that some of our items are going to be in a shop near you in the very near future. Fingers crossed. As always, you can always find ourselves on Etsy and Handmade at Amazon. Again, we're working on some brand new products, as we always are, because if I don't design something new at least once a month, I go insane. But we'll be adding some new stuff soon to prep for the holiday season. And we're adding a few fun items for upcoming Halloween. Those of you who know me, you know it is my favorite time of the year. And I love to experiment with inspiration from our favorite horror movies and shows. So keep an eye out. Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic.
All right, go enjoy your movie.
Thank you.
All right, Benjamin, I know you've got all kinds of things in the works and stuff you're working on, so go ahead and do your plugs.
Yeah, I'll try to make it quicker. It's a little bit easier now because I am Epic Benjamin J on all the things, Twitter, Instagram, and as of the past month and a half, also on Twitch. I started a Twitch channel about a month and a half ago where I'm doing a lot of art and a lot of drawing and painting on what I'm trying to make as regular a basis as possible. It's a little bit harder since I went back to the old day job, but I'm trying to keep some sense of regularity about that. I'll be live again this Thursday night, most likely at 7 p.m. Eastern time, and just check out Epic Benjamin J on Twitch for more information and more schedule information. I do Sketchbook Saturday live every Saturday on my channel, and every other Sunday I do what I call Simpsons Sunday. I just did one yesterday, and I do Simpsons-related art. I take requests for what to draw, like what obscure characters to draw. I'm usually good for about 3 different bits of artwork for Simpsons Sunday each night. And I've been having a good time with it. I'm hoping to, get more people tuning in, and I'm going to get started on some new comic book related, some new, creator-owned comic book stuff on that very channel very soon. So, yeah, it's a good time. Follow, tell your friends, and tell your enemies even. You're all welcome.
All right, thanks a lot, Ben. All right, this week, in addition to what we've done tonight, we've also got Alexis will be back tomorrow to review Muppets Now. And then Jesse will be back on Wednesday on the Metal Hammer of Doom. We're reviewing the new Marilyn Manson album. Last week, we reviewed Mulan, Tenet, AEW All Out, and Agretzko Season 3. So you can go ahead and check those out in the archives next week. The next comic we're doing on Source Material Live will be Punisher, The Platoon. It was supposed to be The Kingsman, but that got pushed to next year. So I had to come up with something to replace it. And Christian was agreeable to talk about a Punisher book that I just picked up in the bookstore. It was on the shelf. It was a limited series. I'm like, hot dog, this meets all my criteria. So we'll talk Punisher, the Platoon, next week. And then the following week, Stars and Stripe by Jeff Johns, because it's Stargirl week. We're finally getting around to that show, so we figured we'd take a look at the book by the show's creator, Jeff Johns. All right, I want to thank everybody once again for being on our show. Until next time, be well, be safe, and behave.